Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Look, after my announcement a few weeks ago, you may not have been expecting any new episodes from me, and yet, here I am. What a kid, eh? Well, actually, the reason is that the author and novelist Elizabeth Chadwick has rescued me by agreeing to talk to me about two of our favourite characters from medieval history, William Marshall and Eleanor of Aquitaine, and who, as you know, I am covering for members in weekly Shedcast at the moment. Elizabeth is a wonderful author, and she recently added to her books on William Marshall with one called Templar Silks, a story that imagines what might have happened during the years William spent in the Holy Land, in Outremer. She has written several novels also on Eleanor of Aquitaine, and she's also a blog which gives some brilliant insights. You can find Elizabeth's blog and all about her books at her website then, https://elizabethchadwick.com, and I recommend it to you. So, we have two interviews for you. This week we talk about William Marshall, which is thoroughly suitable, of course, because this week members will find the first episode about William in their feed. Next week, Elizabeth then talks about Eleanor. I hope you enjoy them both, and don't forget that website again, elizabethchadwick.com. Right, well, I'm very lucky to be here together with Elizabeth Chadwick. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, David.
The occasion for us having a chat was the publication last year of Templar Silks, yeah, which I've read, really enjoyed. And so that was the idea. But then, of course, you've written so much about Eleanor of Aquitaine and the period and William Marshall that I thought it'd be great if we could have a chance to talk
generally
as well.
Yes, of course, sure, yeah.
Great. Yep. So, thinking about William the Marshal first, what drew you to him as a character?
It was curiosity. Whenever I come to a character I'm going to write about, I want to know who they are, what they can tell me about themselves, and what they can tell me that they perhaps never told anyone before, while remaining with historical veracity. With William Marshall, I've written something like 25 novels. I need to count them up to find out.
Right.
And you keep coming across him. You can't not write about the 12th century and not come across William Marshall. And so I became interested in him and thought, for the next novel that I was contemplating, my next contract, you really need a character that's up there and writ large for commercial fiction. And I thought, well, what about William Marshall?
Yeah.
And so I began reading what was available, biographies that were out there. There was Sidney Painter, George Duby, and, of course, David Crouch at the time. And the more I read, the more I thought, well, this is really interesting. And as I began writing, I realised that, you know, I'd got a lot more in my hands than just another subject for a novel. What an amazing man.
Were there any sort of conceptions about William Marshall that you quickly saw or you eventually saw were different than the public perception?
I think the public perception is probably a very broad stroke. He was, you know, the greatest knight. He did all this jousting.
Yeah.
Everybody focuses on that jousting.
Yes.
But it's only, when you look at it, quite a narrow part of his life. It was the young man side. And he did so much more as a magnate, as a Lord of Ireland. It was finding more nuance to the man, I think. I mean, I began out just by thinking, this will be a good story to write. Look at all this derring do. Look at what he got up to. And nearly hanged as a child. All this jousting stuff. Serving kings. Going to the Holy Land. You know, what a story. And it is a story. But there's so much more going on behind that. And there's William the man with all his talents and his frailties. And so it interested me finding the nuance. Whenever I write a novel, as well, part of the asking, who are you, is looking under the surface. There's always that superficial layer, especially when you come to broad brushstroke popular history, and you can just perhaps make a couple of points about a person. But there's always more depth than that to anybody once you get to know them.
So did you grow to like William Marshall?
Very much so. I suppose as much because looking at it, looking at the underneath, at the flaws and things, and the things he had to juggle. When you look at his honour, you find that it's very frequently self-serving, but at the same time, it doesn't do any harm to anyone. Mm. So it's got that sort of light-coloured Luke Skywalker lightsaber.
Right.
Whereas I always see Simon de Montfort as having a Darth Vader lightsaber. So it was interesting just looking underneath.
Right. So I think one of the things I found interesting about Templar Silks was the amount of time you spent building the picture of a religious man. Was that just the knowledge of the 12th century? Was that things that William...
Both. Shortly after William died, his son commissioned a poem to be written about him, written about his father's life, which is 20,000 lines long. And you get little hints in this poem, which was told within... It was published... Finished being written by 1226, which is within 7 years of William's death. Mm. So it's based on eyewitness reports. And you see these just underlying little nuances about religion. He doesn't make an enormous thing about it, but you can see how important it was to him and what it must have been to join the Templars. He only took the vows on his deathbed, and you know, what does that cost a man? But you can see from other just little hints and nuances that he had been probably a Templar follower at least since his time in the Holy Land 30 years earlier. And I think there's very much a fear of hell in William, and that if he doesn't do the right thing and line up all his ducks in a row, he could very well be going to hell for what he had done in his life. Mm. There are things that the histoire skips over that he may have done in his life, and that's the pillaging and burning he may well have done with Henry the Young King. We get none of that in the histoire, but you know that he must have done it.
Yeah.
There's the robbing of the shrine at Rocmadour, which I think was a real watershed for him when the Young King died. I think his visit to the Holy Land was to keep the Young King out of hell, to keep himself out of hell as well. He was still seeking your assurance on his deathbed.
Going back to his life and the progression, you mentioned them also almost being hung when he was a nipper.
Yes.
And then he makes this transformation from the fourth son of a reasonably minor baron into a reasonably major figure in the household.
Right.
Talk through how that happened.
People say his father was not a minor baron. Right. His father was probably middle range, but he was the royal marshal. First King Stephen, then the Empress Matilda. His brother, that's his father's, William Marshall's uncle, was Empress Matilda's Chancellor. William Marshall's mother's sister, so that's his auntie, was married. Right. Yeah, he's still getting mother's brother's sister's father. Yes. William Marshall's auntie was married to Louis the VII's brother. Another of William Marshall's uncles was Archbishop of Palermo. So he was a man with very good family connections.
So that sense that I think quite a lot of people have, that he's kind of made good in some way, you don't think
he has? Oh yes, I think he did make good, but he wasn't at the bottom of the ladder. He got several steps up the rungs, particularly with connections. So he got, as a fourth son, to go and train with one of the top households in Normandy. So that's good for starters. Hmm. And then obviously his next thing was to come home when he found himself as a student, qualified graduate without a job. At the end of it, I went to a few tourneys and did a bit of mucking about, but went home and went to his Uncle Patrick, gave him a job. Now, his Uncle Patrick was the Earl of Salisbury, so that's another, you know, good connection. Uncle Patrick was just about to go off to Poitou to govern on behalf of Eleanor Aquitaine and Henry II as the big shadow behind it all. And so he joined his household. He needed fighting men. So off to Poitiers he went. Then, of course, there was the moment when he and his uncle were escorting Eleanor of Aquitaine on one of the journeys, and they were attacked by the de Lusignan family, who were in rebellion. And William saw his uncle killed in front of him. Mm. He was a young knight. He fought like the blazes for his own life, I suppose, but for Eleanor of Aquitaine so that she could escape, and he was taken prisoner by the Lusignans. Mm. Eleanor of Aquitaine recognised a good man and took him on when she paid his ransom to the Lusignans, took him into our household. and from 1168 to 1170 he was Eleanor of Aquitaine's household knight. Now obviously his skills, the jousting skills, the fighting skills were probably pretty damn good. Mm. She promoted him to become the tutor in arms and in chivalry to her son and heir, Henry the Young King.
Okay, so it's Eleanor who's responsible for that appointment?
Well,
that
possibly Henry. I mean, yeah. Henry would have had full say because it's his heir as well.
Yeah.
But Eleanor would have, those 2 years serving Eleanor, yeah. would have had Eleanor would have gone, oh, I think, you know...
Yes, there's this chap
this
here.
There's this chap
yeah.
here who's... and he very clearly got on with people. He was very much a people person. Mm. I think he could get on with anyone. And he clearly got on with youngsters. Or teenage lads, whatever.
Yeah.
And so he was an excellent choice. And a marshal by birth, which means that you are... The marshals were organisers. Stables, horses, putting the show on the road and organising the household. The ushers were under their control, for example.
Right.
The people who get to say who comes in to see the king. You know,
that's
and
a position
watch out.
Of some
yes.
power, then, yeah.
Yes, it's the same as, you know, and disarming people before they come in and making sure nobody comes in with a knife in or anything. So he's from that family tradition as well. He knows horses extremely well. He knows how to mobilise. He's a military man. He's sorting out payment of mercenaries and things. So it's quite an important job. But as a young man, this responsibility was to train up the young king in arms and teach him to be chivalrous, really.
So what was that relationship like then with Henry II that, as you said, is so important?
Henry was the boss that everybody answered to. With Henry II, well, he's... William's first responsibility, he seemed, while he was serving the young king, was always to the young king, but answering to Henry II. And I think he had to tread a fine line between loyalty to both of them. That must have been really quite a difficult thing to do. And sometimes when push came to shove, he went with the young king, but was probably casting apologetic or dear glances
yes.
towards Henry.
Yeah.
And Henry quite sometimes gave William the blame because there had to be a scapegoat. And William sometimes got the blame for leading the young king into ways that Henry would not lead him into, such as spending too much money and probably having these big ideas.
Yes,
whether
I think
that's true. I don't know.
Yeah, the histoire, if I remember rightly, and I might not do, seems to paint a slightly rocky relationship. But so at one stage, doesn't Marshall get accused of having an affair with the young king's wife?
Yeah, no, not Henry. Yes,
sorry.
He did. I think William probably over-egged himself on the battlefield. I mean, when you're the young king and you're dressed up like a Christmas tree and going out on the field, you want the glory to come to you. And when you've got your 10 years older master in arms, who's really the big cheese with the weaponry, shouting, you know, I think it was God help the marshal. D'excès le maréchal, you can go, oh, he's stealing my thunder.
He's stealing. Right.
And then apparently some courtiers made up this sleazy story that he was having an affair with the young king's wife. We don't know if that's true or not because there's no proof either way. The only thing is that we know that when Eleanor of Aquitaine's niece had an affair with somebody when she was married, the husband took the guy and hung him upside down, had him beaten by the town butchers
right.
and then hung upside down in a sewer to suffocate.
Okay.
So William would know that he was playing very dangerously if he did. And why would he? You know, I think he was quite savvy enough to not go and have an affair with the young king's wife.
He'd have to be pretty mad, wouldn't he?
Yes.
He'd have to be,
But for whatever reasons, William was out of favour and was banished, and the other courtiers moved into his place, probably the ones who'd set him up. And William went to the Shrine of the Three Kings at Cologne, which is quite telling because people pray to them if they've been wrongly accused.
So then he goes to the Holy Land, which is what he writes about in Temple Silks.
He was also, I have to say, when he was banished, he was offered jobs all over Europe. He wasn't.
Is that right?
Yes, the Count of Flanders said, you can stay with me. Okay. Baldwin, Bethune's father, said, you can marry my daughter and be my son.
Right.
You know, and William declined it all. So he came back to the young king, who was fighting with his dad again and with Richard the Lionheart. And was in trouble and needed good military backing. So he was like, oh, all is forgiven, come back.
Yeah.
Which, again, he wouldn't have done if he'd been, you know, carrying on with his wife. So William returned. The Shrine of Rocmadour was robbed. The young king went down with dysentery. End of game. But he asked William to take his cloak and cross to the Holy Land. So that was it. William was off on... William agreed to do it. And once the young king had been decently buried, twice... He embarked on a journey to the Holy Land to take this pilgrim's cross
Too. And we don't know much in detail about what he did. So
absolutely
you have
nothing.
To think if they're and decide what.
Absolutely nothing.
Describe the book.
There's 20,000 lines in Histoire de Guillaume le Maréchal, and out of those 20,000, only 20 cover the entire period.
Right.
I've written actually a blog piece called "What Happens in the Holy Land Stays in the Holy Land."
Right.
Because there's more or less a silence, and even the lines in the Histoire are not accurate. Because they talk about him bidding a fond farewell to King Guy de Lusignan, but he couldn't have done because he was back in England. We know from charter evidence he was back in England months before Guy de Lusignan ever became king. But you can work out things that he may have done quite strongly, such as the fact that he was so in cahoots with the English and French royal courts that he would surely have taken letters from King of England, the King of Jerusalem, the King of Jerusalem being Henry II's cousin, Baldwin, the King of Jerusalem at this time, was a leper. So they were looking for a new king to come and take over, because there was the nearest heir was a 5-year-old child, whose mother was the King's sister and whose stepfather was the dreaded Guy de Lusignan, with whom William had run-ins back home. We also know that Saladin, at this time, attacked the castle of Kerak.
Right.
He did it twice, and definitely on the second attack, which was both times were driven off by the Christians in Jerusalem. We know from the second one that the Grand Master of the Templars organised for visiting foreign knights to join the relief army. So it seems highly likely we know William was there then, and it's very likely that he was at least one siege of Kerak, if not both. The only other thing we know is that he obtained his burial shrouds.
Right.
While he was in the Holy Land, and that they were two pieces of silk, and that they were so important to him that he kept them for 30 years. He didn't tell anyone about them, though, not even his wife or close family. He just, on his deathbed, told a retainer to go and fetch these pieces of cloth from a particular castle. I think, from the description, it was probably Chepstow, and to bring them to him where he was dying at Cowisham. He just got them out in front of his men, who were like, "Whoa, what's this?"
Yes.
And opened out these two pieces of silk and said, "I want to be wrapped in these when I was buried. When I was in Jerusalem, I gave my body to be buried by the Templars wherever I should die." So it's clear that he had made some sort of covenant with the Templars when he was in Jerusalem, that he expected he might die when he was in Jerusalem, and that these burial shrouds he kept for 30 years were extremely important to him, which is the novel's title, Templar Silks. And that they definitely have something to do with the Templars. The year before he died, he also commissioned a Templar cloak to be made and hid it in the wardrobe and again told no one, not even his wife. So it must have been a terrific shock to his family to suddenly have this very sick man suddenly saying, "Go to the wardrobe and get out my cloak, and oh, look, and here are my burial shrouds that I've not told any of you about." You know, so he's been married for getting on for 30 years.
Yeah, so there's something very fundamental and very important
Extremely.
About what happened there.
And Templars, I mean, Templar vows, the full Templar vows were chastity, poverty, obedience, isn't it? But Templars had a thing where you could sign up for a short space of time and you didn't have to follow the vows quite so closely, but you would serve them. Or you could serve them in a secular way, like people are friends of the so-and-so trust. You're friends of this library. You did sort of grunt work for them, but you weren't actually one of them. I suspect that's what he did in the Holy Land. I suspect he was a friend of the Templars. And also the family had Templar connections. His father gave lands to the Templars on his manor of Rockley as a friend. So I think the family had Templar associations that went back into William's childhood.
Okay, great. So then he comes back from the Holy Land.
He goes straight back to Henry II, actually gave him some money to go to the Holy Land.
Right.
For which William may well have put up two horses to get the money, because he left his two best destriers with Henry, who gave him £100, I think.
So I think you paint him as Henry driving a rather hard
I think he did. I think Henry did paint, do so. Nobody gets something for nothing with Henry.
No.
But when he came back, Henry gave him land up in the Lake District, round where Cartmel Priory was built, and also wardships. That means young people who were not within their majority and the right to administer their lands and even provide them with marriages. And so at this time, William takes on John Durley, who was to become his squire at first and then his lifelong friend. And also Howys of Lancaster and Kendal, who I think Henry thought he might, William might think about marrying and make a life in the Lake District up around Cartmel. But William didn't marry her. He did go up to Lake District, and there were a couple of charters from there that show he was up there. But Henry then was having his own troubles abroad and decided he needed a good fighting man, and wrote to William. He says something like, "You're always asking me for more land and influence."
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he does write that, which Thomas Asbridge says that William whines about, but I can't see William whining at all. You know, he sounds like a child in a supermarket,
doesn't
he? Yeah,
that doesn't sound good, yeah.
I don't think he whined. I think it was the power play. William wasn't especially happy to be stuck up in the Lake District when things were going on down in the south, and he'd always been near the court. But Henry was like, "You come and help me, and I will give you." And he offers him, initially, a lady called Denise de Chateau, who was a huge heiress in the border regions that were being fought over. But then there was a bit of auctioneering going on. It ended up the promise being Isabel de Clare, Countess of Chepstow. She didn't have Pembroke at the time.
Right.
You sometimes see it written that she did, but.
Right.
William was given Pembroke by King John in 1199.
Right. And then we get this other key event, it seems, where Henry II and his sons are having their last run-in, and you have this famous meeting between Richard and William.
Oh, yes, it was. Things weren't going well for Henry. He was very sick, very possibly with an anal fistula. And he had to flee Le Mans. He fired the town as he fled. Richard the Lionheart came after his dad, determined to make an end of it.
Yes.
And William turned to face him, lance ready on his horse. And Richard had been so eager to catch up with his dad that he hadn't got his full armour on. I think they said he's just wearing a shorter metal cap and just light armour. And he said, shouted out to William, "Don't kill me.
Yes.
It would be a bad thing to do." And William replied,
"You can see every reason point of view, yeah."
William replied, "I won't kill you. Let the devil do that." Killed his horse instead under him, charged him, rammed the lance into the horse, and brought Richard down, and then spun away and with Henry to safety, brought to Chinon, where of course Henry died.
It's an interesting event, isn't it? Because if the histoire paints it correctly, I don't know whether you think it does or not, it's a very risky thing, a rather wild thing for William to say to the heir to the throne, as it were.
Yes.
Do you think it... Does it ring true to you?
I think so, because afterwards we have a scene in the church where William's talking to his friends and saying, "Oh, God," with his head in his hands, saying, "What have I done?"
Yeah.
Basically. And they are going, "Oh, don't worry, it'll be all right." So I think, even if it might have been slightly exaggerated, I think so, because Richard recognised in William a man who was loyal to death, loyal to the death.
So that's interesting, isn't it? I was going to make... There's a theme, a pattern emerging, isn't it?
Of loyalty.
He stuck with Henry the young king when maybe he should have been thinking about it.
And that was to the death.
He stuck with Henry II.
To the death.
And, that is a theme of his... And yet, I get the impression that David Crouch is less convinced by that. And yes, there is loyalty there, but it's loyalty, as you said, in defence of self-interest.
I think with King John it was definitely loyalty in defence of self-interest. I think with Richard the Lionheart it was... Richard and William were men who understood each other well and could do business together. And I think so, perhaps probably with Henry II too.
Right.
Although he was... He knew what Henry was like. Henry was a harsh master, but... But more so with Richard. I think he was on a level playing field with Richard. Right. He knew exactly... And Richard knew his man exactly too. I think they were well fitted military men who knew the deal. And also he was Eleanor of Aquitaine's man, I think. It's a strong relationship that's not mentioned a lot, because the histoire is very complimentary of Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Right.
And it even tells us things that nobody else tells us, like, but her name is an amalgam of pure and gold, it says. You know, there's little things that come out. She's never ever rubbished in the histoire.
Which is interesting, because she does get a deal of rubbishing.
Yes. I think there was loyalty to Eleanor as well, which drove William, because when Richard went on crusade, William was left behind as one of the men in Eleanor's cabinet, if you like.
Right.
And you can see Eleanor saying, "I want him in my cabinet."
Yeah.
And, you know, he was thoroughly loyal to Eleanor throughout that period as well, and to John, actually, more so than Longchamp. And, of course, there's supposed to have been a discussion between Hubert Walter, Archbishop of Canterbury, he was a very able man, and William Marshall, as Richard was dying as to who they should advise everyone to promote as the next King of England, because of course we got Arthur, who was Richard's nephew, who at one time Richard had said he wanted to be king after him. But so William Marshall has to make a decision. Arthur, the young prince, has been brought up by the French and knows nothing and has no interest in William Marshall, or John, who William has known all of his life, who is Eleanor of Aquitaine's son. Who's going to give me the best deal? So you're weighing it in the balance.
Yeah.
Who should I put my power behind? 15-year-old boy who I don't know and who's not necessarily on my side.
Yeah.
Or King John, who's the devil I do know.
So you think William was as much a kingmaker as that? Very influential in John succeeding to the throne?
Well, John rewarded him with the Earldom of Pembroke. He needed William's support, because William was seen as an honest guy who people would listen to.
Right.
Everyone was willing to listen to what William Marshall had to say, which is evidenced out throughout at the end of John's reign, or after, when William was being regent, the country pulled together behind him. So he got the gift of the gab, if you like, the gift of persuasion. So you needed William Marshall on your side to tell everybody that you needed to be king.
Right.
So being a kingmaker sounds a little bit dramatic. And,
yes, sorry.
Ricardian somehow.
I was being Ricardian.
But yes, it's within that. I think it's on the same page.
Right. Okay, great. Yeah. But they fall out at some stage, don't they, Marshall and John?
Yes, it's over France that they fell out, because William had all this land in Normandy and he could see it disappearing as John lost Normandy. And of course William wanted to keep it because he was very prolific as a father and had five sons and, you know, he had to find land for them all. And so he did homage to the King of France and then pretended it was a sort of a minor sort of homage that
didn't really matter.
And John got a bit narked by all this and then they had a row about it. And also John had been dabbling his fingers in Ireland and had been sort of misappropriating lands and putting his finger in lands that were not perhaps quite, you know, officially his. So when William decided he was going to Ireland to sort out Leinster, which belonged to his wife, that's a big chunk of southern Ireland, John was like, oh, I don't really want Marshall going meddling in there. I'll tell him he can't go. And William went anyway. So John, being very suspicious of William because of France, because of Ireland, took two of his sons hostage. William said, OK, fine. If you bandage a finger, this is what he's supposed to actually have said, if you bandage a finger that's not injured, it's still the same when you take the bandage off. And John was not at all happy about all this, and William was under a cloud for quite a bit. William had got a very sharp economical brain as far as making money went. I think he'd been short of money as a youngster, and gum, he was never going to be short of money again if he could help it.
Yeah.
And Ireland needed developing. If he died, then his wife had to have something to live on. And so I think Ireland, the bath tracks that were in her, were part of her dower.
Yeah.
So he had to, Ireland was underdeveloped and it had problems of ownership, which needed all sorting out. So that had to be done. Also, King John was having trouble with the church and it had been put under interdict. And it was like, well, we can get away from the interdict by going to Ireland. There's all that. John's not very happy with me because of France, and I'll probably just shuffle off quietly for a bit and, you know, kick some butt in Ireland and get it all sorted and keep out of the way for a bit.
Right.
But John pursued him to Ireland, and so there were, again, more problems. But William and Isabel rode them out. At the time, while William was in Ireland, he founded the port of New Ross, which was upriver from John's own port. But William adjusted the tolls, which made them a lot more favourable for people to come up the river to New Ross and ignore John's port.
Right. I mean, it's quite interesting, because there's a big risk, isn't there, about
a huge risk,
defying the king in those days. Mm. You could lose everything. But he took it. So
he took it. I think he realised that John needed him as much as he needed John.
It was a political calculation.
Yes, he was quite a political player, a sharp political player. And I think that going to Ireland, things had to be done in Ireland.
Right.
He took that risk. He got a lot of friends at court. He had a big faction at court. And he thought that, you know, he could probably
ride it out
and take that risk.
And then we get to the last period in his life where Magna Carta, the revolt of the barons, and he stays with John.
John summoned him back to ask him for help, and he came and said yes. But I think he'd perhaps thought about it, because there is a letter from John saying, "And beware of any ships that come from Ireland from William Marshall, because they may be a danger."
Right. So John thinks he might.
John thought at one point, but at the height of his paranoia, John thought that William might actually come and attack him.
Yeah.
But William didn't. William came to his aid. Mm. He must have had a good think about it. I mean, his wife Isabel was very anti-John.
Right.
From what we can tell, but. William chose to support John.
Which reminds me of a question I was going to ask you. In the books, you write about quite a strong relationship between Isabel and William. What do we know about that relationship?
We know, again, it's just picking up delicate little hints from the histoire. Several times she's mentioned in the histoire as being present and having a voice in his inner council.
Right.
So he's consulting her. Mm. When she was heavily pregnant when he was summoned away to court to answer for various things to King John, he left her in Ireland, and he says, "I have nothing without her."
Right.
I think you can take that as a political statement, as rather than a Valentine's Day statement.
Yeah, indeed.
But there's some of that in it. There's the 10 children as well. Which, I mean, I suppose they didn't have to love each other to beget the children, but when you add it up to the other things.
Yeah.
When he returned to Ireland, the histoire says that his return was much to her taste, said, and that, there's this really happy reunion. They did have an argument about what he should do with the people who hadn't been as loyal in Ireland as they'd hoped. She wanted to, be strung up, basically.
Right, she was the hardliner then.
She was the hardliner, and he said, no, I've done enough here, you know. But they were able to have these discussions.
Yeah.
Sometimes he agreed with her, sometimes he didn't. But she'd had the rule of Ireland while he was away. And at the end of his life, when he died, she was with him. There's a very touching scene in the histoire where they're sobbing after he's taken his Temple of Vows and she can no longer embrace him, which is written in the histoire, which... when that happened, it was 1219, and the histoire was finished by 1226. So this is
this is recent history.
Yeah. There were eyewitnesses to this, and also when he was at his funeral, she was in a collapsed, very unwell state, and she actually died less than a year after he died, although she was 20 years younger.
Right.
It probably took a big toll on her. So there are some very good pointers. Yeah. That they were a strong and loving partnership, which, given the state of arranged marriages and the fact that they hadn't met on the day they married, or they'd only met the day before they married. And the other thing is, the consideration was that after they married, he took her away for a month to a country house to get to know each other, have a honeymoon, if you like.
Right.
You know, so... get married and then not straight back into business.
So this is not a man who, I suppose, is also a bit of his reputation, which is kind of very military, slightly dense, unfeeling sort of bloke. But not like that at all then.
No, George Duby sort of makes him out to be dense. I read his biography once and then basically wall-banged it.
Right.
No, he's very, very intelligent, very sharp and very understanding of people. You couldn't be dense and get everyone behind you and do what he did. You have to have a really incisive, clear mind. He wouldn't have served the Angevins from 1168 to 1219 without having those skills. Emotional intelligence, he got people skills, and he got military ability. I think he had those in spades, and that's not hero worshipping.
Yeah.
I think when you look at the evidence of what he did in his life and who he served... Mm. It would have been game over if he hadn't any of those at some point earlier.
Okay, so we were at the sort of final bit. He supported John throughout.
Yeah.
John dies crossing the Wash, and he is at that point very important to England's future, isn't he?
That's right. He was already in the field fighting because there was civil war in the country. The French had invaded and had taken over London and were threatening Dover. Had got as far as Lincoln, where the famous Nicolas de la Haye was. Constable of Lincoln was holding out against the French. William Marshall was made Regent of England.
Mm.
By a decision of the barony, the only fly in the ointment was the Earl of Chester, who was a bit younger and quite bolshy and strong-willed. But everybody preferred to follow William Marshall. Mm. I think that's true, but I think it's a little bit over-egged in the story. But William Marshall, the histoire claims, didn't want the job as such. because he was around getting on towards 70, if not already 70, and it was quite a big ask. And apparently he cried when offered the job and said, "Look at me, I'm an old man, and the boy has no money." This is the 9-year-old Henry III.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lost cause. And then everybody came into him, his close counsel, the men, and said, "You know, like, buck up, get on with it.
Right.
If you can't, you can do it. You're the only one."
Yes.
And so he sort of wiped his eyes, had a stiff drink, and said, and "Okay, let's go."
Yeah.
And took over the regency, and basically got people talking. He sorted out. They got no money, but he investigated what John had got at various castles in the royal treasury, and used that to pay the mercenaries. And by various hand-to-mouth methods, kept the country running. Mm. And then it was up to he decided to go up to Lincoln. Where the French were threatening Lincoln Castle, and to go for a battle. One of his ideas was, as they got within sight of Lincoln, he told all the baggage train, gave them all banners and said, "Look, we're going to look twice the size we are."
Right.
So he was handing out, you know, banners to the washerwomen and what have you, and wave these and shout.
Yeah.
So they think there's a huge, mighty host coming to put the wind up them. Then they found a way to break into Lincoln, because this lot didn't come out to fight. They all went back into Lincoln, the French.
Hmm.
But he found a way in through a blocked-up doorway, or one of his, you know, associates did. And that was it, street fighting.
Yeah.
William got so excited at one point that he was supposed to put his helmet on before he went into battle, and he forgot. And his squire had to come running up and say,
here's
your helmet. And William was like, "Oh, God," and put his helmet on and...
Which has a little resonance with that lovely story in his younger days with the battered up helmet and how he put his head on an anvil. And
That always amuses me that as a young knight he got his head stuck inside his helmet and had to have it pried off by a blacksmith on an anvil. And in the meantime he'd won the main prize of the tourney, which was an enormous fish, a giant pike. And so people were wandering around with this fish on a salver trying to find him. And finally found him at the armoury. So the first thing he would have done when he finally got his helmet off and drew a gulp of air was the sight of this fish on a plate.
Fish, which I think I'd have been a little bit disappointed about, to be honest, as a tourney prize. But there you go. It appears in The Knight's Tale. I don't know if you've ever watched that film.
I've seen A Knight's Tale, yes.
Well, they do. They obviously take that story when Heath Ledger has his...
They have whole quotes from the Histoire in A Knight's Tale.
I love that movie.
That bit where you'll be measured and found wanting, that's from the Histoire de Guillaume
Maréchal.
That is amazing, an amazing film, because you can watch it on so many levels.
Right.
If you know your medieval history, you can hear all these bits that have been sneaked into the script.
Yeah. I love that movie. So with that, so he's the unity candidate.
The unity candidate, yes.
He?
Yeah, everybody gets behind him. And so he kicked the French out. There was another big sea battle at Sandwich, which he didn't join in, but watched from the shore. And that was the end of it. Louis was brought to terms, although England had to pay a fine.
Mm. Politically, he's at the top of the tree.
Yes, he's the French have gone. They can start rebuilding the country.
Yeah.
But then, of course, very shortly after that, perhaps the stress and strain of having to do all this made him ill. And he became ill at the Tower of London in sort of the winter of 1218. And the doctors said, sorry, mate, you've had it. And so he said, right, well... I'll be a lot more comfy at home than here.
Mm.
So he went to his favourite manor at Caversham to die. I think he came to Caversham in the February and started, tied up all the loose ends and handed over government to various different people and sorted everything out, telling the young Henry III that he hoped he died an early death rather than become like some certain wicked ancestor.
Right. Okay.
King John.
Yeah.
Which is perhaps on his deathbed what he really thinks about King John,
yeah,
even though he served him. And so February to Caversham, and he died in May, mid-May.
And his death, if I remember right, it's a bit of a state occasion about his funeral, isn't it?
His funeral, yes, it was in procession. He had to, he lay in state at Reading, and there were a couple of other places they stopped, I can't remember. But he finally came to the Temple Church in London, where he wanted to be buried. And he was.
Yeah.
And that's where his resting place.
So at the end of that, when you look back, what is William Marshall? You know, a fantastic story, or does he have any particular relevance to us now? What do you take out of the whole story?
Well, yes, it is. It's an amazing, fantastic story of a man who would have been I think, amazing and fantastic, whatever century he lived in. I sometimes think of him in terms of being the 13th century Nelson Mandela, getting everyone together and not having bitterness or begrudging. Right. He could be a blank slate and go, okay, you know, we've not got on, but we've got to do this.
Right.
We can't go forward unless we do this. And you get that quite strongly from the histoire and reading round. That's what I get from it, and honour. So there was always this this thing of doing things for yourself, but doing things for good, and not for harm.
Okay, so that's William Marshall. Thank you very much. That's really good of you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, then, everyone. Good luck, and we'll be back next week with Eleanor.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.